It's Interstates. I'm Alex Chambers.
When Diane Kondrat was refining her skills as an actress, she went through a 2-year course on the Meisner technique. Part of the goal of that technique is to give you the ability to respond naturally to another person's behavior. It's not till the second year that you try to do it in character. The whole first year is just about doing it yourself.
For a while, I thought that learning that technique would allow me to practice that in real life. But let me tell you, in real life, truth isn't always what people are looking for. Another reason to prize the stage above real life.
On today's episode, we hear from Diane Kondrat on theater and life, right after this. This is Interstates. I'm Alex Chambers. I grew up in Western Massachusetts. As a teenager, I had a feel for the South, the West, the general Midwest even. But Southern Indiana didn't exist as a place. If you're listening here in Southern Indiana, you might think that changed with college, that I was applying to schools and IU came up as a world-class university. It did come up, actually, because I was looking at music schools. The conservatory here was apparently renowned. I didn't quite believe it, though. I didn't apply. I've been here for 20 years now. I feel like a naturalized Hoosier. And it turned out there were more things in Southern Indiana that I dreamt of. Still, sometimes I wonder what things would have been like if I'd landed in a big city. So, when a friend was coming to town to see the locally famous actress, Diane Kondrat, in a one-woman show, I jumped on the chance to join and to talk to Diane. Because, like me, she had big dreams as a teenager. She wanted to act. And she probably wasn't dreaming that she'd make her career doing regional theater in a set of relatively small Midwestern cities.
I don't think that's what most actors aspire to when they get started.
A comedy show. I didn't know we were doing a comedy show today. That's better. I feel better already.
Diane's been acting for 45 years, a lot of those years here in Bloomington, Indiana. She formed her own theater company, two of them, actually. She was also a regular at the Phoenix Theater in Indianapolis and at Cardinal Stage, the professional theater in Bloomington, once that got started. She's since moved to Portland, Oregon, to be closer to her grown kids. But she came back to star in Cardinal's production of Every Brilliant Thing. It's a one-woman show about a girl trying to ease her mother's depression with a list of all the best things in the world. We met up at Butler Park in Bloomington on a beautiful day in early September. We talked about getting into acting, making a life in regional theater, and how to just be with another person. But of course, I wanted to hear about her origins first.
So were your parents artistic?
Nope. My dad played the accordion. Does that count? I come from poor people. And amongst poor people, the arts, especially a career in the arts, is nothing but crazy talk. That's just wrong-minded. And my father's Ukrainian, my mother's Lithuanian. And I know that my dad at one point, I was talking about how I didn't sing well enough. And he said, oh, you're Ukrainian. It doesn't matter how well you sing, you just sing. But even saying that, there wasn't that much music or art around the house. My parents were big theater goers, though. I was born in Newark, New Jersey, and if my mother had kept the programs from the year that she saw the premieres of South Pacific, The Music Man, West Side Story, I mean, they went to the theater all the time, but they didn't want me to be in the theater.
Were they sort of struggling financially, or were they sort of in that sort of immigrant kind of thing of like, they get here and they manage to sort of
Both of them came from quite poor families, but they ended up being in certainly upper middle class, I'd say, by the time I was, you know, like in grammar school and stuff. My dad was he was in retail and finance and retail, one of the reasons we moved as much as we did. But yeah, there was a little bit of time before my father lost his job, the company Jacobson's in Ohio, a department store. When I was like a junior in high school, I wanted a dress. And I thought, oh, that dress is expensive. And then I thought, well, I'll just say. And so I said, and they said I could have it like right away. And I thought, hold on, I think we're rich. And then my father lost his job. And that was the end of that. He became an insurance man. And my parents lost quite a few friends because I was shocked. Quite a few friends because they were not in the appropriate social strata anymore. Ain't that garbage?
How old were you when that happened?
I was in high school. I was halfway through high school.
Did you feel like it affected you?
I didn't feel it that much, but my mom did because she had, I remember the brochures she had of New England, fancy New England colleges, where she was hoping to sell me into a very lucrative marriage and set me up for the rest of time. And I mean, they were all over the place. I mean, I did well in school. Those brochures were all over the place, and they were very nice. And when she realized she had to send me to a state college, she was heartbroken.
So what about you? Were you already planning on studying theater?
I was very cowed by my parents, and especially my mother was. There are people who are listening to this who I'm sure know my mom because she lived here for a while. She's a very powerful personality. And so I did what I was told. And I know people who broke up with their parents when they graduated from high school and went and did whatever they wanted. I did what I was told, which was go to school. So as it turned out, for the first 2 years of college, I switched my major. I wasn't allowed to be a theater major. I switched my major at least three times, ended up taking all of the requirements for a Bachelor of Arts. And then when got married when I was 20 to a writer, much to my mother's continuing chagrin. This is one of the happiest memories of my life. I was walking to class the first day of my junior year of college, and all the books in my arms were theater books. Because I was finally going to be a theater major, and I was on at least half scholarship. I auditioned, and they were like, oh, we'll give some money. So, yeah, I was so happy to be able to finally be a theater major.
What? How did you manage to do that in relation to your mother? Having gotten married?
Yes. These were the olden days, you understand. So once that happened, they were so mad. I mean, they were mad. I started dating the person I married in May, and we got married on August 2nd. And part of that was that I was going to get to be a theater major because all bets were off. They weren't going to pay. They were mad. They weren't going to pay for college anymore. And so he would get his money from one window, and he'd walk three windows down, and he'd give it all back to pay for my undergrad. Because he was teaching there at the time. He had just graduated with an MFA in fiction writing. This was at Bowling Green State University.
Okay, so you studied theater. Ultimately, you managed to study theater in college. And then what next? How did you sort of move from college to actually working in theater?
Oh, I have nothing but... I have really sad stories for you today. I have another sad. That was kind of a happy story. This is a very sad story. It took me years to recover from this story. When I graduated from college, I went to something called URTA, University Resident Theater Auditions. I believe they still have them. They're national auditions for jobs and for MFA programs and stuff like that. I got 14 job offers, some from London, some from Paris. I won't even name the programs, the masters, the MFA programs that I received offers of full scholarships from. But my confidence was so low that I absolutely remember thinking, what is wrong with these colleges that they send people to interview you who are mentally ill? Because people were telling me they were going to build their entire master's degree program around me. This happened a lot at those things. And I didn't believe, I thought they were crazy. And then everybody talked about it because this was after I'd been married 2 years. So my parents were back in the conversation. Everybody talked about it. And Tony had a job offer in Norfolk, Virginia. And he said the magic words that, don't worry, more opportunities will come your way. For anyone who's listening, take the opportunities the first time they come your way. Do not, I repeat, do not wait for them to come again. So I never took any of those 14 offers. And I moved to the East Coast to a very large population base is the Tidewater area in Virginia. And I auditioned everywhere I could when I got there and did as much theater as I could. My father was dying a few years after that, while I was still in Virginia, and he wanted me to get an advanced degree so that I would be safe for the rest of my life. That's how we get safe. And there was no MFA close. I had already had my son, Nicholas Conrad Artizzone. But there was an MA. So I have a Sterling Masters of Arts in the Humanities from Old Dominion University. I'm not sure it's going to save my life. Oh, but I did get all A's. And my father was happy. I mean, when your father is dying and says, please, I'll pay for it, go get your master's degree, you say, you betcha, I surely will. So the funny thing I did there was Christian Broadcasting Network is there. And let me tell you, they've got a lot of the Lord's money, or at least they did then. And so everybody worked for Christian Broadcasting Network every time they called. So there was that. And I helped run a theater that was associated with Old Dominion University that was kind of a combo pack. Yeah, I helped to run it. I also cleaned the toilets when it went from being a porn house to a theater. Yeah, I remember that. So I did all the theater I could. And a lot of radio was being done then. I did a lot of radio in Richmond, Virginia. It was wonderful work. So I patched together a life, because the truth for me in all these years is that I knew that without theater, I couldn't keep breathing right. The theater is the safe place for me. And without that, oh my, I knew I would just fall apart. So there wasn't a choice. Oh, maybe I'll get involved with theater. It was like, I have to find a place. And I did. So the Riverview Playhouse was my home. It was close to where I lived. And I worked there for the whole time. We were in Norfolk, Virginia for 9 years, which prior to that, I had never lived in one place for that duration of time. So that was the first time I lived someplace for a long time.
All right. So you were in Norfolk. And did you come to Bloomington from there?
Yes.
And so you're moving from Norfolk to Bloomington with two young kids.
Yes. My daughter was 3 months old and my son was 5 when I first came to Bloomington.
And you were already acting and you're coming here wanting to keep acting. How did it feel to move here?
It was stunning. I had a dream. There's a cemetery at High Street and Covenanter that people who live here will know of, because it's a beautiful little cemetery. And there's still one great big tree that kind of hangs over the road, but there used to be another one and it's gone down now. And before I had ever seen the cemetery, I had a dream that was a photograph of that cemetery. And the voice in the dream said, I hope you're ready, because this is what it's going to be like. Because even though I was in Virginia, which is not, you know, when people say, oh, I want to be an actor, they do not say, get thee to Tidewater, Virginia. There was a lot going on. There was a lot going on there. And I came here and there was not, certainly no Cardinal stage. And I did what I do, which is go to every single organization that I can find that is doing theater and bring my resume and bring my headshot and say hello. And I'm polite for a little while. It's really trying, but I do it. And I might even wear some clothes that look like you could wear them, you know, for a commercial or something. And so I did that, and I did not find what I needed in town. And so I started producing myself as Oasis Productions. I had $2,000. My father died, and I had $2,000 given to me by my mom when my father died. And I used that $2,000 for the next 18 years. I spent it and I made it back. And that was the money for a theater company.
Wow.
I worked for free. Mostly we had to pay rent. We had to pay royalties. Of course, we had to have some kind of sets. We had some kind of lights. The only people who reliably got paid were technicians, because I didn't know enough people who were like, sure, I'll run your lights. Oh, who could actually run lights, right? Oasis Productions was small cast shows with great roles for women. Gee, I wonder who any of those women might be. So as a producer, it was a pleasure to be able to do pieces that were engaging on an intellectual level. I remember doing a Naomi Wallace play called One Flea Spare that actually I was looking into right before COVID happened. It's about the last time the Black Plague came to Britain and these people that are stuck in their houses with a guard because there's been plague in their house. And somebody came up to me at the end of the, a woman came up to me at the end of the show and she said, why do you do plays like this? This woman is suffering and you're giving an example that's very, very dark. I have another play that was amongst my favorites. Perhaps people remember Mom and the Razor Blades by Wendy Hammond, who used to teach at Ann Arbor. It's a part of a trio of plays called Family Lives, Three Brutal Comedies. And it happens on Mom's birthday, and it's a terrifying play. She beats one of her children to death behind a couch with a baseball bat. And it's like a cartoon with stuff flying out. So if I have something that I favor the most, it's dark comedy is my favorite. But I like darkness all around the neighborhood. Not as much as some people. And I'm happy to say I don't remember this playwright's name. He's a man, and he's made a lot of money, and people really like him. And I can't remember his name, and I'm glad about it. His plays are so dark. Maybe banging my head into something about hitting my head with nails or banging my... Oh, he's famous. I hate his work. There's a pessimism that comes from some people when they do dark stuff that it's like, well, you should kill yourself instead. You know, I don't have to read this. You should eat it, choke on it, and die, because obviously that's what you want to do, right? So there has to be, I think, in the stuff that I like, either stuff that's so funny, and like when we did our Fringe show, me and Karen Irwin, a Fringe show written by Eric Pfeffinger, Assholes and Orioles, that we took to different places. It's so dark that you're laughing and laughing because it's like, oh, no, this is awful and so true. That then you feel better because you've laughed about it. So that's one thing that can happen in comedy. But the other thing that when something is really dark and it's in dramatic work, there's an indomitable spirit, I think, that for me really always exists in women, because the oppression of women is so popular. It's a worldwide popular event for hundreds and thousands of years across all kinds of cultures. It's like, wow, okay, how does that work? So by the nature of doing plays that focused on at least having 50% of the roles be really good women's roles meant that you were highlighting an oppressive situation that still she lived through it, and her eyes are still open. And of course, her heart is even more open because it's been shattered so many times and then had to rebuild itself into a more vibrantly functional organ. That was and all these are very long answers.
This is Interstates. If you're just joining us, I'm talking today with actress Diane Kondrat. We'll be back with more after a short break. This is Interstates. I'm Alex Chambers. I'm talking with Diane Kondrat. By the time she moved to Portland, Oregon in 2014, Diane was an almost 30-year veteran of Southern Indiana theater. But we're still in the early days here, when she was cycling $2,000 through her company, Oasis Productions. In and out. In and out. She needed more work. Because she's the kind of person who puts herself out there, someone came to her aid. And it wasn't just her future collaborator, Nell Weatherwax.
It was God. One day, I got a phone call from Dee Dee Foster at the county jail. And she said, I had already been a producer. She said, I'm writing a grant for using interactive theater in the jail for HIV/AIDS education. And I need somebody who knows how to do theater. Can I put your name on it? And I said, you bet you can. And if you know anybody else that's writing a grant and they need somebody who knows how to do theater to put their name on, you don't have to judge this. My name, just spell it out and put it on the grant. And so she got the money, and I contacted Nell. She contacted me. I contacted Nell, and it was like, what are we going to do? And then we started. Also, Chris Jaffe, who I believe still lives in town, was one of our original members. And we had it needs the form that we used. It's interactive theater has many, many forms. Sometimes it's called applied theater. But the way we did it, you had to have three actors and a moderator to do a one-hour show. And so we needed four people, and we got four people, and we became competent in the form. And it was really exciting work. My brother had spent time in federal prison. It was very hard for me to go inside jails and to hear as anybody knows who has worked in prisons, hear the door close behind you, see people literally in chains. That was really hard. That was pretty fresh when my brother killed himself rather than go back to jail. So that was pretty fresh at the time, but it also, like a lot of people, made me eager to serve that population who finds themselves in the American prison system, which is certainly a whole nother show. So we started to do that, and I will be frank, at the time, HIV rates were rising among the white, male, heterosexual population. And you can't let those people get sick. So all of a sudden, there was a good deal of money. Later on, when HIV was rising more among women of color, that money went away. But, you know, it took a while. So, we did a lot of work all over the state in juvenile facilities and adult facilities doing HIV/AIDS education for a long time. And that's where I learned how to do improv. Before I did What If, and there was two names. When we finally got 501c3 status, it was Interaction Theater Incorporated. But before that, it was What If Programs, because we were always sitting around going, what if, and then what if, because you had to write a scene, a very short, tight, urgent scene that was written for an actor as a kind of map without specific lines. So you learned the story. You didn't learn specific lines, but it had to be crafted so it could come to a reasonable, believable point within 5 minutes. So it always had to have some really high stakes going on. And we were always like, so what if he comes in now and he remembers, you know, that kind of stuff. So we finally called it What If Programs.
Why did it have to be improvised? Like, why not the lines?
Because that was the form of interactive theater that we chose.
Okay.
And it also prepares the performer, because the way we did it was in an hour, we would do three different scenes. The scenes were not connected to each other like chapters in a book. They were independent. People kept their own names. So if I was an actor and I was Diane in the first scene, I would also be Diane in the second scene, but it would be a completely different situation. After the scene happens, the moderator stops the action and then facilitates interaction between the audience and the actors while they remain in character. So it's not like we told this story, now we're going to talk about it. No, 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 no. The scene just ended and he's got his hand raised and he's going to punch me in the face. And then the moderator stops the action and says, well, what do you think she should do? So then the story moves in a way with all of a sudden it's like instead of three people in the scene, there's 33 people in the scene because everybody in the room is in the scene now. So it prepares the actor for that moment, but it also means that you need less rehearsal because you can bring somebody in if they're good. You can bring somebody in, show them a story and say, okay, do the story. And then you don't have to be like, oh, on that line, you know, you have to say, please put your foot over there before I, no, no, no. You can say whatever, as long as you get that thing, the intention going. But before I did those programs on stage, if I missed a line or somebody else missed a line, really the only thing I could do was repeat the last thing I said and look hopefully at another person. Maybe I could say their line, but I could never come up with anything, right, that would save me in a moment. But after doing a few years of the interactive theater, that took care of that problem.
So where was that in relation to your Meisner training? Because I was just reading up a little bit about Meisner, and that's part of the training in Meisner too, right? Is repeating
being
lines,
in the moment, being in the moment. The repetition exercise, which is a basic part of the Meisner technique, really the use of the word repeat or repetition it probably should be called a different thing because that's really not the essence of that. The purpose of the repetition exercise is to teach you to work moment to moment off another person's behavior, responding moment to moment as things happen. So it's don't think, just be there and be fully with the other person. So of course, that's all the yes and stuff that you hear in regular improv stuff. So I started to learn Meisner when I was in my early 30s. And it was around the same time. Yeah, we were doing, actually we started the prison work before that. So yeah, it was around the same time.
Okay. So yeah, those both sort of helped you.
You know what? We should probably go back. And the purpose of the repetition exercise is to teach you work moment to moment off another person's behavior, dealing with that behavior moment to moment as it happens. I'm going to try to say that. The purpose of the repetition exercise is to teach you to work off another person's behavior, picking up each. God, I feel really bad because this is my teacher. She'll hear this. The purpose of the repetition exercise is to teach you to work moment to moment off another person's behavior, dealing with that behavior moment to moment as it happens. I'll just leave that in the air. So it's very much to make you act without thinking,
yeah,
and act without judgment and act without trying to. And by act, I mean be, right? Be towards somebody without trying to be clever. It's like, no, 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 no. We don't need you to be clever. We'd rather you were truthful.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Because in a lot of instances, and for a while, I thought that learning that technique would allow me to practice that in real life. But let me tell you, in real life, truth isn't always what people are looking for. Another reason to prize the stage above real life.
That was actually my next question was like, did it affect you and did it shape your real life at all?
Yes, because many things. I mean, the way Meisner technique is taught in a 2-year program, the first year, anybody can do what they're teaching. You don't have to be an actor. So the first year teaches you how to be present with another person while life is going on. In, of course, theater, it's fictional life, but anybody can learn that. And then the second year, you learn the things that allow you to alter yourself to serve the playwright and be not Diane in a situation, but somebody else in their situation. And not everybody can do that. I had some students when I was teaching at IU, there's a thing called a hot who, an adjective and a noun that deeply and succinctly reflects your point of view. So if you were in a show and somebody had a gun on stage and that person knows that gun is not loaded, it's a prop gun, right? And they're dealing with that prop in such a in a really casual fashion, you could change it to say, okay, I need you to hot who that gun, and it better be the alarming weight, right? I had students that you would invite them to consider using a tool like that, and they would tell you that they would tell you the name that they gave it, and it would have no effect on how they touched it. And I was like, uh-oh, well, you're probably not an actor then. But what I did learn from studying Meisner technique that affected me in my real life is really the benefit, and this it has extended so far, the benefit of listening without judgment when you're interacting with a person. Just to be there and listen to people, and especially, especially now, people are not used to having somebody look at them and listen while they're talking. I mean, how many times have I heard people say, oh, stop me if I've said this before. I will not stop you. It will have to be many, many times you told me this today before I would stop you, because obviously you have a desire and a need to tell whatever story you're telling me, and it's going to be a little different, just like every show, a little different every time. People are so hungry to be listened to and attended to in a non-judgmental way. Another thing that happens in Meisner, and perhaps other acting things, is you look at people and you study people without saying that's bad what they're doing. You just say, oh, that's how they walk. That's how they tilt their head. That's how they don't look at me or do look at me. And that, you know, they're another letter in the alphabet. It's like, oh, look, I can use that, but I'm only going to use the way he walks. I'm not going to use the way he swings his arms or the way he tilts his head. It really invites people to be more human, right? To practice being human, which also I used to watch happen in the interactive theater. When we would be, especially in prisons and juvenile detention facilities, where we always did our best to be alone with the people who lived there without any guards in the room or anything like that, so that people could make mistakes in communication, which happened a lot, right? Especially the assaultive verbal practices against women, if there was ever a woman character, and there was, that was perceived as misstepping. Oh my God, the violence that immediately came out, and the moderator would have to say, can you think of a different way to say that to her? Right? And then they got to practice, right? They got to practice being a human being. And that's what, you know, that's what happens in theater in all different ways, that you get to practice all the different ways to be human. So, you know, I could be wrong, but the idea that being present and non-judgmental and fully open to another human being is the goal. That this is a good thing. This is the way to do it.
Yeah. I was curious about COVID. Obviously, as an actor, you lost a major, major, huge part of your working life. And then you were in this Zoom group with our mutual friend, Toby Bercovici, the director. Were there surprises that came out of that? Like things that worked, things that you learned?
Yes, it was wonderful. The biggest, and I always said, I feel like I'm kind of along for the ride, right? Because I'm a much better presenter of other people's ideas than I am as the one that has, you know, the big idea. So I would watch what other people would do, and it's like, oh, that's really good. The interesting lesson was that often the most engaging thing that was presented on the screen music always had a huge effect, or even sound, but music always had a huge effect, but it was almost always aided by the simplicity of the action, which is also highlighted in Meisner. It's like, don't just hit the nail on the head. My teacher would say, just hit the nail on the head. Not too much this way, not too much that way. Don't comment on it, just do it. And that thing of being simple was mesmerizing on the screen, which maybe film people know these things without even, like some, one of my friends, I do sketch comedy in Portland with Spectravagasm, and Sam Dinkowitz, who was the mastermind of all this, he's like, yeah, big deal. So after COVID, all these theater people will have the same kind of talent base that film students have in the first 3 months of taking a course. Yippee, aren't we smart now? So, you know, it's a different genre. You know, for years, people would tell me that I should do more film or do more television. And I never want to do it because of the aspect of the audience and their energy output being absent. Yeah, people will say, oh, well, the crew is there. Please, that's not the same at all.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking today with actress Diane Kondrat. We'll be back with more after a short break. This is Interstates. This is Interstates. I'm Alex Chambers. We're listening to a conversation I had with actress Diane Kondrat outside at Butler Park in Bloomington, Indiana, on a gorgeous, cool day last September.
So you've been acting for 45 years. You've figured a lot of things out. Are there new challenges at this point in your career that you didn't expect to be facing?
I think for me, a lot of them are the same, which is finding good work and good people to work with. My dream with shows and with casts is to have somebody that's better than me so I can learn more. One of the things that's happened now that I'm the age that I am is I get cast as men. In Portland, I played Ronald Reagan. I played Adolf Hitler. And I played a little guy from New Jersey because they couldn't find anybody who seemed like they were from Jersey. Nobody knows how to talk anymore. So all of a sudden I'm playing men. So that's pretty kooky. I mean, I've pretended to be a man before, but these are instances where I'm actually supposed to be a man. And with the Ronald Reagan thing, what? How tall was he? I mean, he was a movie star guy, thankfully. In this play, Passion Play is the name of the piece, he already has a little of his Alzheimer's stuff. And I didn't know until the last minute. They gave me a microphone, and that saved my life because he already had that kind of breathy, hesitant quality to his speech, which would have never worked if they hadn't given me a microphone. And then literally the day before we opened, they gave me a mic, and I was like, oh, I'm saved. So that's a new challenge. Other than that, you know, when I look at myself and what I prefer, I have a real addiction to beauty. And that is well served by this truck that's going by. Well, wait
sure
for
is.
It.
Yeah, let's wait for it.
I have a real addiction to beauty that is well served by being in the Pacific Northwest now. But when people are like, oh, just because you're older, you know, it doesn't mean, you know, you're not going to have parts or something like that. I know that there are people who think that old people are just as beautiful as young people. I don't know, man. I really like to see beautiful people, I mean, bodies are the forms that are in theater, right? And unless you're the kind of director that toys with that form, which is thrilling, that's what you get. And I understand when people don't want to see anything but what they perceive as the most beautiful thing that's on that stage. Now, sometimes it is true, often it is true that the most beautiful emotional life is presented from somebody who's mature, and the most beautiful physical life is presented by somebody who's young. So what are you going to do there? I don't know. A lot of radio. It's a problem. So I know that I have missed being cast as a lot of queens because I am not tall and I am not thin. And it's like, oh, that's never going to happen. I'm never going to be tall and thin. And now it's like, well, this is the body that I have, which I know is supposed to be the point of view you always have when you go into an audition. Here I am. It's probably what you're looking for. This is what I got. It's for you. But it's a big shift. I mean, I say now, my sexy used to be worth more than my funny, but now my funny is worth more than my sexy. And it's hugely true, partially because if you're good looking and a woman for a long time, it was like nobody wanted you to be funny. You were one or the other. You were either pretty and probably it'd be best if you shut up, or you looked a little goofy and then you could be funny. So that has changed for me in the kind of things I'm being asked to do. But even when I was much younger, people would say, oh, you're a character actor. But I think that's because I naturally am comfortable assuming different ways of being. One of the first books I ever read in my life was entertaining my mother with a book that was all vaudeville radio plays. And everything was written out in dialect. So I was very comfortable with all these different ways of being. So I've been a character actor. It's not like I've become a character actor. So as far as new challenges, the only new challenges are to come up with even more ways to keep theater alive and in service to human beings, despite the push toward technological involvement. When I know that kids spend so much of their time, and some adults too, playing video games and never having the sort of reward of intense human interaction that theater gives one, it's like, oh, come and see what this feels like. So that's the challenge for me, is there any way that I can help continue a tradition that needs us as humans to be together? I mean, when you think of something like Clowns Without Borders.
I don't know it.
Clowns Without Borders is like Doctors Without Borders, but they're clowns that go to refugee camps. These are the saints. These are the performative saints in our world. That kind of healing that happens through emotional interchange is a really powerful thing to keep us all alive in what seems to be an increasingly frightening time. I took a weekend class with Giovanni Fusetti. He's in Italy right now. He's a clown and a teacher and a Jungian. And I got to watch this workshop. He's a fabulous clown. Helikos, H-E-L-I-K-O-S, I believe is his company. And he teaches all over the world. I saw people in this workshop. I think there were only two performers in the workshop. Everybody else was a social worker or a psychologist or a teacher. The transformations I saw among these people under the guidance of this clown were spectacular. And I think that can only happen in theater. I had a plan that I would go back to school to be a drama therapist once nobody wanted to cast me anymore. But if you are curious, it's really expensive to become a drama therapist. Holy moly. And it takes a lot of time. I frankly don't have the money to do that. So that is something that, you know, if that somehow became an easier way for me to approach that, I certainly would, because drama therapy is an astounding process. Yeah. That's all I got.
That's great. That's a lot. You weren't planning on ending up in Bloomington spending 27 years here. You've since moved to Portland, which I'm not in that much in the theater world, but I'm guessing is also not sort of a big the destination for theater. Has it ended up being satisfying working in the more regional kinds of theaters?
In case anybody needs to know, Chicago is the place in the United States that if you want to do beautiful theater, that's where you go. However, there was a moment backstage at the Riverview Playhouse. I was doing a play called Shadowbox, and I was playing the daughter, the unfavored daughter of a woman who was very ill, who kept waiting for a letter from the other daughter. And then that daughter started to write letters to her mom under the guise of it being from the other daughter. A lady came backstage. I was taking off my makeup. She had those great big 80s glasses, right? She was a little overweight. She was not well-dressed. Her glasses were so up against her cheeks that it was like pressing them up against a window. And I believe her glasses were not clean either. And she came backstage and she found me, and she was very quiet. She was a big woman, tall woman, but her voice was so quiet. And she touched my shoulder and she said, "Thank you very much. That was my life, that story there with my mom. Thank you." And then she went away. Those moments are the best. And, you know, they can happen anywhere. You don't plan them. You don't sometimes know. I mean, she came back and did an announcement, right? She came back and told me. Who knows, for any of us who are performers, how many people feel not so alone in the world once they have been with you and the show that you're doing or the performance that you're doing. And I have a friend she's a scholar. And what she said to me recently was, "Well, you know, commercial theater in New York and commercial theater in fill in the blank, it's all over. It's only money. It's big money and it's people making money. And if you can get those..." Oh, somebody talked to her about, you know who the actors are now? Only rich people's kids. Because that's the only people who can afford to live in those particular towns, who have the kind of connections that say, "Get me a job," who will have a family member who can donate to a theater. Man, I'm not naming names. And then that person gets cast. And she was like, you know, it's going to go back to the case where it is regional, smaller, more intimate theater presentation that becomes again the true art, where money is not the ruler of the interaction, where shared humanity and the need to perform, the need to be in an audience, because, you know, not everybody wants to be on stage, but man, there's people that want to feel the big feelings that come in the theater. And so I would like to have a lot of money. I would like to have people just, you know, clap when they see me walk down the street. That'd be pretty swell. But that's not the heartbeat of being an actor. The heartbeat of being an actor is finding another heart, right?
Diane Conrad, thank you so much for taking this time.
Thank you.
If you miss Diane in Bloomington, you can catch her in Portland. She's not stopping anytime soon.
My mother-in-law, who I went up to Chicago to see yesterday and get new headshots, she said, she's 96. She has nothing to do with the arts. She said, I can't believe it. You're so old and they're still paying you to do things. I was like, yeah, it's crazy. Don't tell. Yeah, yeah. So the fact that I still get opportunities to do things is super good, because not everybody does, you know?
Yeah.
You've been listening to Interstates. If you have a story for us, or you've got some sound we should hear, let us know at wfiu.org/interstates. That's INNERSTATES. Speaking of found sound, we've got your quick minute of slow radio coming up. But first, the credits. Interstates is produced and edited by me, Alex Chambers, with support from Mark Chilla, Michael Paskash, and Kate Young. Our executive producer is John Bailey. Special thanks this week to Diane Conrad. Our theme song is by Amy Olsner and Justin Vollmer. All right, time to take a breath and listen to a place. You've been listening to A Train Over the Beeline in Bloomington, Indiana. Until next week, I'm Alex Chambers. Thanks for listening.
Riding back at the top of the Hunter's Moon. Subliminal, we make the rounds and soon.